Welcome back to the Everything is a Primary Source podcast, the show where we unpack history by way of pop culture. I'm your host, Eric Paul, and for the next hour or so, we'll be analyzing media to see what it can tell us about the time period from whence it came. I mentioned last week that when Daramy of the Bigger Than the Game podcast and I talk, we really do talk. You can't stop us. You can only hope to contain us. This was absolutely true when we decided to tackle ESPN's SportsCenter, and the result is a two-part episode. If you missed the first half, you don't have to go very far. Just to last week's episode, the Season 3 premiere, and you'll hear it there. But before we dive back into talking about SportsCenter, here's a conversation I recorded with a drop-in guest named Ted during one of my exhibits at Prescott Park in Portsmouth, New Hampshire this summer. Take a listen. All right, so I am here with Ted, who's visiting from Chicago, correct?
Correct, Chicago, Illinois.
Awesome. And here we are at Prescott Park in Portsmouth, New Hampshire. Are you visiting on vacation here, or do you have family in the area?
Visiting Vermont and New Hampshire and Maine on vacation. My wife does have a friend who moved back to Vermont after living in Chicago, so we've never been here.
What do you think?
Oh, it's really nice. We don't have mountains in Chicago. We just have buildings that pretend to be mountains.
Yeah. Impressive on their own, you know, on their own right, but it's, I guess, our... did you happen to go through Bennington, Vermont, which has the largest structure in northern New England?
I don't think we did.
You would have seen it. It's the John Stark Victory Monument, which is to commemorate the Battle of Bennington, which didn't actually take place in Bennington, Vermont. It was further down the road in New York.
Oh, I can tell you're a social studies teacher.
Yeah, it's like this weird blessing and a curse that I have combined where I just absorb information and...
Cool.
And in the case of what I do here, it's just like I see everything in that context. I'm like, what is this? What's that trash can over there? Tell me about, you know, this time in history. Oh, it's actually a recycling can. So that tells me.
Well, we did drive up to Mount Washington.
Oh, okay.
Up to the top.
How are your brakes on your car now?
the brakes are fine.
Okay.
I figured out low gear.
Yeah.
But it was kind of neat to see that that's where the highest recorded wind speed ever took place. And
it won't be long now before we get it on the news of, like, you know, the temperatures and the winds being recorded there. You know, it's usually around October that they're like, and it's negative 45 on Mount Washington. I'm like, well, yeah, it's on the top of a mountain. Of course it's going to be windy and cold. But, yeah, they start doing that pretty early on to tell us winter's coming, you know. But Chicago is no stranger to winter. Bad, cold weather and lots of snow.
True.
So from my table of artifacts, all these different books and CDs and tapes and all sorts of stuff, and I'm glad I brought this one today. I read that book a couple years ago, and I just thought it was great. It's Apollo 13 by Jim Lovell and Jeffrey Kluger. And the copy that I brought has basically the cover of the movie, the Ron Howard movie starring Tom Hanks and Kevin Bacon and Gary Sinise and all those guys on the cover. So clearly a two-prong, you know, trying to get you to buy the book and to let you know, kind of a marketing ploy of like, you know, ploy, but marketing scheme of saying like, this movie about Apollo 13 this is its source material, is a guy, he himself, a primary source of that mission, you know, so he's the one that wrote this. So it's based on that. But you got to meet Jim Lovell, is that right?
I met him. I can't tell you that I remember many details about it, but it was in the Chicago area at a conference of some sort, and I happened to have the hardcover book in my possession, so I knew he was speaking there. I brought the book with me. I asked him to sign it, and he's got some history in the Chicago area after the space program. I know as when I was a child in the 60s, I was really into the space program. I don't remember Mercury. I kind of came into being during Gemini and Apollo. So
yeah.
I kind of remember the story of Apollo 13, but definitely seeing the movie and reading the book kind of reminded me and reinforced my memories.
And the question that I chose off the, so I have a form for those of you listening for the first time. I have a template of questions that I ask, and the question that I, you know, to dissect these, but for these short episodes, we just do one. And the one I chose is, what was the maker's status and role in society? And Jim Lovell and all those guys, and I know he describes in the book about when they were first brought in to NASA and, you know, recruited basically out of the different, you know, branches of the military, that they were kind of made fun of by their colleagues of, you know, what are you going to be, a spaceman? Like, what is this? They didn't take it seriously. But definitely by the time Apollo 13 went up, his status, I mean, these guys are like human computers. Like, they're brilliant people.
Yeah, they were the rock stars, so to speak. The Mercury astronauts, and I'm quoting from another movie and book, The Right Stuff, but, you know, they were immediately looked up upon by people in the U.S. As just these people that were willing to risk their lives with new technology. I think, you know, getting on top of what used to be a missile, a person never really sat on top of one and asked to be strapped in and sent into orbit. But I think what you're saying, like, by the time they got through Mercury, Gemini, and Apollo, say, 8 through 12, they had a lot of experience. And then here comes Apollo 13.
Yeah.
And something went wrong.
I think, and he touches on this in the book, if I remember right. He was on, I believe, Apollo 8, and maybe even designed the insignia for that, of the 8 going, because they just orbited the moon on that one and then came back.
I appreciate your reminding me of that. Apollo 8, the actual capsule, is in a museum in Chicago.
Oh, okay.
And I'm guessing it has something to do with Jim Lovell's connection with the city and living there. And he was a CEO of a corporation, I think.
Okay.
After the space program.
Because when we think of, you know, the geography of NASA, we usually think of just, you know, Florida and Texas, and that's it, you know, because of, you know, where they launch them, and then where, you know, from this story, the famous Houston, we have a problem, from Mission Control. And, but in reality, that entire program recruited and needed the entire country behind it. You know, thousands of people, mines, you know, from MIT and from, you know, University of Chicago, I'm sure, and Northwestern, I'm sure, was, you know, contributing in some way or another to it. So it's like the actual mission itself, not even the book, but the mission is so much like a product of where the country was technologically, scientifically. You know, all the advanced minds were on this program. And so I feel like I if you don't mind just popping that book open and seeing if when the publication date of the book itself.
Yeah, sure. Was, I can check that.
I know that one would come out with the movie, but I wonder what the original publication
was. Yeah, this one is 1994.
Yeah, that would be for the movie.
Copyright 1994. First pocketbooks printing July 1995.
Oh, okay.
So we're coming on 30 years for the movie and the book.
And does that check out about around the time that you saw him in person?
That probably sounds about right. Okay. Yeah. But I think you're right. The astronauts, you know, when they selected the astronauts, not only were they the top pilots and top reputations in the military, but they were engineers. They were smart people. Yeah. They knew science. Other than weeding out women, which weren't allowed in the program at that time, you're right. These were the top people in science and technology, and they knew about flight, and they were selected, and they came through, especially in Apollo 13 in an emergency situation.
And that, I think, brings up a good, you know, reason to talk about here. And I just want to bring up that the movie Hidden Figures came out a couple years ago and shed light on people who, you know, women, African-American women, who were very part of the program out of Virginia but didn't get the recognition until later. But by 1994, when this book comes out, and then shortly thereafter the movie, 1995, it says something that I don't think most people, without watching that movie, like, I wouldn't have known as a kid, Jim Lovell. But Ron Howard, who directed it, and Tom Hanks has had a major role in bringing, you know, in that era, he was He produced a HBO series called From the Earth to the Moon, which is all about the various space, you know, Apollo and mm-hmm. other space programs. Mm-hmm. And like it, because in that era we were on a new precipice with the internet. I remember cloning was talked about a lot, like this new frontier of, you know, as we're approaching the 21st century, this is what we're going to be doing next. And so stories about things going wrong, but getting it back where it should be. And, you know, cause as they say in the movie, and I think it's in the book somewhere, like, this will be our darkest moment. No, this will be our proudest day. If we can get these guys after this debacle safely home, it's going to say something. And so gave kind of confidence for the 1990s moving forward.
I think the only quote that I really remember from the book or the movie or the transcript is something to the effect of, okay, we have the LEM, which is the Lunar Exploration Module, attached. We still have the LEM attached. Let's not blow the whole mission.
Yeah.
In other words, they were saying, we've got a lifeboat if we need it.
Yep.
We've got systems that are still running on one of the two vehicles at least, and we have all of our brains and all the engineers and
all the guys
people
back home. Yeah,
right.
Just working
on this.
It's
a great story.
Because when you see the like the images of all the guys working on it, it's like, you know, dazzling to think that they were all the reason why they were able to do that. I know you got to go check on the car. I hope you enjoy the show tonight.
Thank you.
And thanks for stopping by for podcast karaoke. And
yeah, thanks. I hope a lot of people listen.
Yeah.
I hope a lot more people listen. And I hope it'll
absolutely
pan out into some of the other museums, especially where we are in the Midwest.
Spread the word.
Thank you.
That was a great TED Talk. Hey, if you like what comes out of these podcast karaoke sessions, head on over to everything-history.com. There you'll see details about having podcast karaoke come to you for your next function. These can be done in person, like today's, or virtually. Everythinghistory.com is the online hub for this podcast, too. It's there you'll find links to my Substack, Instagram, and other social media. That's everythinghistory.com, everything-history.com. I paired this short up with the main topic of ESPN Sports Center, particularly Sports Center in the mid-1990s, because I feel like Tom Hanks movies like Apollo 13, Forrest Gump before that, and Toy Story swirl around in my head together with so many other sights and sounds whenever I get nostalgic for my teenage years. Unlike the opening days of ESPN in the late 1970s and early 80s, by the mid-1990s, the network and show, and cable TV in general, had a lot to compete with. But as we see was so often the case in that era, the mid-1990s, the attitude in a lot of media was, if you can't beat them, make them mash together with you. Books were reprinted with movie covers. Animated movies were made into home video games. Hootie and the Blowfish were making music videos as if it was an episode of SportsCenter. And the list goes on. Anyhow, I'd like to welcome you back to the big show.
When I think about that landscape of when cable came out and what, there's certain people who got it. And they were, I'll call them visionaries. And I'm glad you, because Nickelodeon was a big cable network that helped change the game. So I appreciate that you mentioned that. But you look at like the people who ran Nickelodeon, you look at Ted Turner, Vince McMahon with pro wrestling back then. He saw cable, that's his time to go global.
Yeah, paper,
that was a big thing. Yeah. And ESPN, these certain factors, MTV. They were visionaries and they saw like this open platform and they did the thing. I'm sure other people said it, but I heard Steve Jobs say it, which is your audience, the consumer, they don't know what they want until you show them.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of times that's what it is. We don't, and that's the truth in a lot of things. We don't know we like it until we're shown it and someone has the smarts also the guts to say, I'm going to show this to the world, to the masses. And then we go, hey, 24-hour sports.
Yeah. How did I get along without this?
Yeah. Right. It becomes that. Why didn't we think of this years ago? Like, this is brilliant. But we don't know it until we see it. 24-hour news, of course. Things are always happening. But you're always going to get the people going, what? That's crazy. But if you stick with it and keep being persistent, then it's like, yeah, we want that.
And Steve Jobs is also of that same era. It's like that same mm-hmm. generation of people, you know, sort of that, you know, I don't know if they'd really fit into the category of boomers necessarily, maybe like silent generation, you know, born in and around World War II era, maybe just before it, who were shaping things, you know, throughout the 70s and 80s and stuff like that. And, you know, both with like technology, computers, saying by the end of the century, everybody's going to have one of these things in their house. And it's mm-hmm. going to be really hard to get by without a computer. By the end of the century, everybody's going to have cable TV and you're going to be able to watch. I mean, just think about right around the same time as, you know, in Sports Center turned that corner, as you were mentioning, came the movie Back to the Future Part 2, which had mm-hmm. that vision for 2015. And honestly, as funny as some of that stuff is, the part where, you know, Marty Jr. goes home and turns on like 10 different channels at once and it's around the clock, everything. That's kind of what we have. It might not look exactly how they predicted it, but we have it. You know, it's like that kind of thing. You know, I'm still waiting for Pizza Hut to come in a pill form, but, you know, or dehydrated version. It's actually one of my next topics I'll be recording about is Back to the Future Part 2, that movie.
Okay.
So it's like visions of the future are usually like 90% of that is based on what you have at that moment. It's really difficult to, but it takes, like you said, visionaries, people to say, all right, I got to get past the limitations of what we have now and look bigger picture. I got to look at where do we want people to, you know, meet us 10, 20 years from now? What's going to be part of their normal life? So I think that the founders of ESPN would be very glad to hear that by 2002, my buddy and many other people incorporated their channel into their daily routine, that they, you know, really wouldn't be able to finish their day unless they found out what the scores were from all the different games that went on earlier that day. When it comes to the geography of it, I think that's also very telling of the capabilities of cable. It's kind of like mm-hmm. where we are now on this, you know, frontier of podcasting where, and just internet work in general, you don't have to be in the big media centers to take part. You don't have to be in New York, LA, or Chicago. You can be in anywhere, USA. And if I'm not mistaken, was it Simmons who had a connection to the Hartford Whalers, that he had been working for them and he got let go?
Yep.
And then mm-hmm. So he was already in that vicinity. And my dad's side of the family is all Connecticut. And it was actually, my dad's more from like Hartford area, a little bit north of Hartford. And a couple of years ago, I just was talking to him about something related to Connecticut. I think I mentioned I drove through Bristol on the way, and he just did, in kind of a funny voice, he just goes, Bristol, like that. I'm like, what? He's like, oh, that's how they talk there. I'm like, I wouldn't know a Connecticut, like, he knew the different Connecticut vocabulary and
the accents and stuff.
Accents. I'm like, okay, I guess I'll take your word for it that people in Bristol talk like that. But he always described, and I mentioned him, like, why do you think ESPN ended up there? He's like, I don't know. It's not, I mean, it's about the halfway point between New York and Boston, you know, two big sports cities. So that there's some significance there, but being that just the satellite, you know, had been around for a while, they didn't need to be in Manhattan. They didn't have to be in LA. I know they have studios there, but Bristol is still their headquarters. What does that tell you about the time period that you could set up a successful cable channel? I mean, Ted Turner was doing it in Atlanta. Not that Atlanta's mm-hmm. a small town. It's not Bristol by any means, but it's still not usually in the same list of major media markets. What does that tell you?
Well, first, cheap.
Yeah.
A little bit, I'll be honest. So, like, you know, probably today, I don't have the real estate numbers in front of me, but back in the 79, cheaper is more of it, more land, and it's cheaper to build. You need buildings and satellites than, I find that New York, Connecticut, it's cheaper, to be honest. But I think it was, so I think it's part of that, but I also do think it, for real, it was smart because now sports are happening all over the country and the globe, but there is something, there's great rabid sports fans in America everywhere, but the Northeast still has that thing. And I feel like kind of like what you said, it's close enough. It's not a crazy hike where we want to get somebody to the Knicks game or to a Mets game or to a Red Sox game or to Philly or to DC and Baltimore. We can kind of get there, and that's like a good hub to have, and so I think that was a key. And also, like you said, like there's these monumental things, like when, hey, the internet can go anywhere, you can connect to everywhere. When we're looking at, people knew the power of television, and then when you expand it to cable, and like you said with Ted Turner, Atlanta's a big city, but hey, from where he's at. And how big was that? Where, hey, the people know the Braves because he, you know what? I'm going to use cable and I'm going to put my baseball team on this network. And so many people who didn't have a baseball team in their city, they were Braves fans. I meet them to this very day because TBS, they were watching Ted Turner's Braves back when they stunk. All they had was Dale Murphy, and that was it. But they were watching the Braves. So it was those who kind of sat there and went, okay. And I believe the guys at ESPN were like, where can we set this up? And yeah, if we can get our people on the field out to where we need to get, like in the Northeast, and we can kind of grow it from there, Bristol, Connecticut, and also less distractions. So you can get people to stay at work more. They're not tempted by the nightlife. There's nothing to do besides help build this new up and coming network, so you'll work round the clock to do it because you're not going anywhere,
I
sad to say.
remember a couple of years ago on the 40th birthday of ESPN, Dan Patrick had all the alum on, and they were trading stories about like the one bar that was around the corner from the studio that they would go to, and that was it. Like they didn't have, like you said, distractions. They weren't going to be going out all night as you would in a big city, and potentially getting into trouble and stuff like that. Bristol would keep you pretty well focused on what your job was, and the crazy nightlife of Hartford, down
Or yeah,
the road.
right. Or
Like,
New
oh,
York, because of New York or Philly, big cities, it's like
yeah.
you get done at 2 or 3 a.m. There are things that are still
Yeah.
open if you want to partake in, Not judging anybody, but just
Yeah.
saying. In
Bristol is a town
Bristol.
that does go to sleep.
Right. It's asleep and it slept hours ago. So nothing else for you to do but go back home and do it again. So I think that was part of it too.
I wonder if it gave any kind of not incentive, but just like motivation from other organizations, whether it be broadcast television or just anybody else, saying, well, yeah, we don't need to be in these places. We can just do it from here. We don't have to, because the next revolution that came after cable was the internet, and similar time period. And there's how many of those dot coms started out of somebody's house in the middle of nowhere. It's like Zuckerberg was out of, Cambridge with Facebook and everything. He was kind of pushed to go out to Silicon Valley because they said that's where the talent is. That's where you're going to find other people that can work on this with you. But he could have, and he did, get started here in the Northeast. He wasn't, he didn't have to go all the way out there to do it. He had his, stuff going on. So it's like that era was so unique when it came to, it wasn't like 100 years before where the industry that you were getting into relied on a specific location in the country. The new technology made it so that you could really get going anywhere, and the lowest bidder won. I mean, we're seeing the same thing happening in our time period now with movies and TV shows. Like, very few of them are actually still made in LA because it's so much more cost effective to go to Georgia or, you know, Indiana or even Canada to make your stuff than it was, you know, back in maybe 50 years ago. So, yeah, now that I think about it more, now that you shed more light on it, yeah, Bristol, the geography of it, it makes perfect sense. And put them on the map. Anything else that we haven't quite covered when it came to the behaviors and ideas that are conveyed by way of SportsCenter? I mean, let's maybe talk about just like where do sports fall in the priorities in people's lives? And definitely ESPN would put it saying this should be a high priority of yours.
Yeah. I think the behaviors that it kind of showed was like, and I'm not saying people didn't feel this before ESPN. Like that, it's one of those big connectors with people, honestly. I think for people, definitely guys, but I think men and women, if you're meeting someone new for the first time, one of those go-to icebreakers that you try to go to is like, you a sports fan?
Yeah.
You know, I always hear, hey, this is my name. What do you do for a living? And one of the things that I know I come up with, like, oh, do you like sport? Do you like this? Do you watch the game? Mm-hmm. Like, people just kind of say it. And I think it showed the popularity of sports. It showed the business of sports, honestly. Like, it's big business. And I think even with the pros, it was growing. But I think ESPN, SportsCenter kind of helped to show pro sports and college sports, in a way, magnified the big business and magnified, like, oh, like we see now all the time, these, even today, these streaming platforms bidding for rights for shows and bidding for content, sport content, live things. A big part of that to me was coming from that impact of ESPN and SportsCenter and people wanting to be on SportsCenter and people, hey, athletes getting more money, networks getting more money. All these things kind of happened. The 80s was a boom for money and, you know, Wall Street and, you know, yeah. Gordon Gekko, greed is good.
Yeah.
So I think that's kind of what it conveyed. You know, we also started seeing on a national level, people talk about player contracts, coaches contracts. That's getting discussed on SportsCenter. So-and-so signed this new deal for how much money? You know, that's becoming, instead of localized, now nationally, that's a conversation. I remember, this is in the early 2000s, but when A-Rod, everyone will remember the $252 million contract A-Rod signed. And we all heard that on where? The 6 o'clock Sports Center. He signed with the Rangers. He's getting that much. And now players are making more than that. But at the time it was like, can you believe a baseball player signed a $252 million contract? So to me, I think, It just kind of showed the business side of it in a way. And like you said, the ease for entertainment and money. Mm-hmm. I think that's what these things kind of conveyed to a lot of us.
There was also, I think, the spiritual side of sports was conveyed through it too. And just how important it is to, as an uplifting thing for people. Also could be if people take it too seriously, because I wonder if there's a correlation between people tearing up their cities when their team wins the Super Bowl or the World Series and, you know, cable sports shows. I don't know if that happened any other time before it. You know, you make these, like, rabid super fans to the fact they're like, ah, you know, I can't, you know, I just can't control myself that we won. But I remember when Mickey Mantle died. And yeah, they had, you know, the coverage of the funeral was on ESPN. And they, of course, talked about it and Mickey Mantle's life. And I remember Keith Olbermann getting very emotional on SportsCenter talking about how important Mickey Mantle was to him and his generation. And understanding that the players that we were watching, you mentioned Ken Griffey Jr. earlier, he was a big deal for us. He was kind of like a, you know, we loved hearing news about him because, you know, and collecting his rookie card. And even right. like this, I think that the sports card, especially baseball cards, is no coincidence that they had a huge boom in popularity right in line with SportsCenter rising as part of our lives, because just as my routine in that age, in that time period, included watching SportsCenter in the morning, it also included going to the baseball card shop in the mm-hmm. afternoon and spending whatever I made from mowing lawns and doing chores and stuff on packs of cards. And the cards right. even looked, the design of them seemed to have a lot of, you know, like those Upper Deck cards kind of looked like SportsCenter opening screen, you know, the lines,
yeah.
the silver and,
you're
you know,
right.
and they, the way that they, you know, literally framed the players on the cards changed with the 90s when that became a big business. You know, if you look at some of those cards from like the 70s and the early 80s, you know, sometimes you feel like saying to the guy, like, you know, they're taking your picture, right? Like they look bored. Right. They're just like some guy sitting on the bench, like, you know, but by the time you get to, I remember the line of cards that was part of the undoing in my sports collecting career, and was actually brought my brother and I to a point where my dad cut us off from buying cards for like a month, if not longer, was the Studio series. I forget if it was Fleer or Score or something like that. It was called Studio, and it was all the best players in the league, and they like brought them into a nice photography studio, and they were like Bo Jackson, I think he was in that series, you know, like he was like shirtless, just holding his bat across his back.
Yeah.
And like, you know, they're like doing like poses like against, not like natural. It wasn't like gameplay type stuff. And I loved it because even though the pack cost like $350, it was like guaranteed there was going to have all stars in it because those were the only people they invited to take these pictures. But then I'm like, oh, wait, like I should have thought about like they're not going to be worth anything because they're all good. You know, it's not like 87 tops when you have 900 cards and, you know, a bunch of guys that don't even play very much have their card. When you find the Mark McGwire rookie in there, that's
right.
big deal because it's like, you know, it's the, you know, supply and demand. But it was like that same era of that culture that ESPN was so part of creating. Of sports are important. You learn a lot of great life lessons from, you know, you can revolve your entire life around them, you know, following the stats, following the
right.
individual players. You don't even have to be in the city that they play in or near the city they play in. You can become a fan of Bo Jackson on the Kansas City Royals. And then when you move over to White Sox,
well, yeah.
you know, you're still fans. And how many of those black White Sox hats, you know, were sold because, you know, SportsCenter was highlighting him and Frank Thomas playing the same team, you know?
You're right on that. I think many people will say one of the most important moments or episodes in SportsCenter history was that day in 95 when Mickey Mantle died.
Mm.
And when you talk to Dan Patrick or Keith Olbermann about their time together on SportsCenter, they will, at the top, go to that episode where, and we've talked about the irreverent, jokey, but they showed that they took it serious. They knew how to be serious journalists. And that for me was the biggest sign of, I knew who Mickey Mantle was. I obviously didn't watch him play, but like you said, like that was one of those times where, like, for me, everything kind of stopped that day when Mickey Mantle died. It was like that big of a story. And they captured, which now as an adult, I think we get, you know, sadly when Kobe died or other athletes mm-hmm. died, wow, they define a generation and they define an era for a lot of people besides just sports, but in culture, that was one of my first times seeing that, where Mickey Mantle, for a lot of people of that age, of that boomer age, growing up in the mm-hmm. 50s and into the 60s, he was that boyhood hero. He's who you wanted to be. he was like a Superman for a lot of people, but he was on the baseball field. And they did an elegant, and if people haven't seen it, you can go on YouTube and watch them do it. They did a great job of breaking that down, you know, which I think now we're used to, but at the time we weren't used to seeing it that way. So that's a great point. It was a connector, and it was kind of like everyone went to ESPN that day to hear them talk about Mickey Mantle's death.
Because you knew it was going to be part of their world, it was going to be hit the hardest. That, you know, he hadn't even played for, what, 30 years?
At least 30 years,
yeah. And so, but it was still, he was one of, it was like the last of the Giants that were still alive, you know, of like that Yankees, you know, kind of like classic, you know, he was kind of the end of the line for that, you know, because he had played for a short while with DiMaggio, and DiMaggio had played with Gehrig, and Gehrig had played with the Babe, and just like that succession of Yankee
mythology, really.
Yeah, and so it was like the end of an era, and I mean, not that it was a good thing that he died at all, but I mean, it was going to happen at some point, even considering the way he treated himself. But 95 was like that whole new era was really taking shape, that as we're hurtling towards the 21st century, the torch was going to be passed. Well, and a lot of those players that we were watching, you know, maybe not ever get to the same level of mythological type, you know, status, but I still think about the players I used to watch those highlights of, and you know, some of the better ones, like you mentioned Ken Griffey Jr., Tony Gwynn, you know, was that same time period, and watching those guys play. And then when I hear their names brought up now, I feel like an old man. I'm like, that's when baseball, you know, Paul Molitor, you know, that's when baseball was baseball. Yeah. You know?
Well, speaking of that, a moment that really, they both in 1989, there's two moments, both baseball related, that really shaped how ESPN, but SportsCenter, most importantly, to, you know, our topic, how it kind of changed their fortune and how they were looked at for the next decade or two. One is the way ESPN and SportsCenter covered Pete Rose. That was in 89, him being banned from baseball for betting on baseball.
Yeah.
And the serious way, you know, Bob Lee and them getting into it, and really SportsCenter was a place to go for him. But probably just as big was that 89 World Series with the earthquake. I'm wearing an A's hat for those who can't see. But the A's and the Giants, you know, that Bay, you know, West Coast World Series, San Fran and Oakland, game threes in San Fran. You know, if you're a baseball fan, you know it. But that clip, you know, ABC has the coverage, and Al Michaels is doing the intro with Tim McCarver, and oh, it starts shaking, and you have an earthquake, and then it kind of goes blank.
Staticky, and yeah.
And where did people turn? ESPN had a couple generators and stuff, and then SportsCenter, you saw Bob Lee, Chris Berman, people went there to see what happened. Are people okay? And then they're showing footage of like, okay, because, and I'm not from the West Coast. I had one earthquake here in Philly back in 2011. I didn't feel it, and it did some damage to some buildings in the city, but
a trash can fell down or something.
Pretty much. I was at college, and it got announced like, you know, there was an earthquake, and I'm like, really? I was watching YouTube, and I'm like, it's like summertime. I go, oh, an earthquake happened? I go, did y'all feel anything? So ESPN showing footage, though, of, okay, this earthquake rocked, I think that was Candlestick Park, Candlestick in San Fran, Candlestick Park. The game, you know, people were scared, families were onto the field. But not only that, then you're getting footage of, no, this rocked all of San Francisco. Yeah. This is a catastrophic and deadly earthquake, and how serious it is. And a lot of, they're getting that footage, and they're watching Bob Lee and Chris Berman talk about it. Those are moments where, like you said earlier, it's sports crossing over into mainstream news. And instead of being on the sports page, these moments like Pete Rose or the earthquake during the 89 World Series, those are front page news in general, like events that people turned to ESPN and wanted to see and hear their coverage.
I remember watching that game, you know, live when all that happened, and I remember the regular news coverage was terrifying because watching all the highways collapsing and cars going off them and the bridge and everything like that, it was like so hard to really fathom. And it's because it was a sports, you know, the World Series was happening. You're absolutely right. It's like, you know, 10 years before they, well, I guess 10 years before they would have ESPN to turn to because it just started. But, you know, they...
It wouldn't have been what it was,
the previous decade, they wouldn't have been able to, you know, like, okay, how is, you know, ESPN's going to cover, you know, the sports aspect of it. Kind of like the movie Superman Returns from 2011, around the, or that era, you know, 2007 or something, when he returns, and coincidentally, it's a baseball game that he lands the plane that's, you know, pummeling to the, you know, coming down to the earth. He lands it nicely on the baseball field. They go back to the Daily Planet, and there's Perry White handing out all the assignments. You know, he's back, and he's like, all right, sports, how's, you know, they're going to clean up that plane off the field, you know, and he hands all
right,
the
right, right.
So it's kind of like earthquake hits 89. Okay, you know, we're going to go over to the meteorology and the science guys to tell us about the actual quake itself. We're going to go over to, you know, the traffic and all the, you know, the regular, like, human interest type people for the, you know, those who are affected and their homes were destroyed and stuff. We're going to go to ESPN because they're our sports guys. You know, we're going to turn things over to them. How does this affect the actual, you know, can you have fans safely in the stadium for the rest of the series? You know, do they have to inspect it for earthquake damage? And what if there's aftershocks? Is that going to, you know, what do we do to this actual, you know, gameplay?
And part of that is, you know, we talked about it for Super Bowl I, like the change with football overtaking baseball. But I want to say this right because the World Series is still, like, it's a huge accomplishment. It's a big deal. But I feel like definitely in the 50s, 60s, you know, before, but even in the 70s and 80s and into the 90s, it wasn't on the Super Bowl level in 89, but the World Series was still a huge event. It was a big, like, I feel like the World Series now doesn't have
that feel.
But back in 89, it was like the world's, it was still like, this is a big event. So that's what really did it. And I think younger people now wouldn't, they would get an earthquake in the world. They would understand, but they wouldn't get, like, that's why that was a big deal, because the World Series was still like that thing where everyone's watching the world. All right, World Series, it's a big event. It's on prime time now. Like, we're going to watch it. And so that's why it's like, wow, this thing interrupted the world. Like, we haven't had delays in the World Series before. This earthquake is big enough where not only are we canceling this game, but now there's a delay in between games for this series, and who knows when we're going to be playing baseball again. That was a huge deal.
Right. And we wouldn't really see anything like that again until September 11th.
Right.
Where once again, you know, and I don't, the whole time around that was a blur still to this day for me, but I can be sure that ESPN was covering, you know, with good tact, I'm sure. How does this affect the sports world? Because, you know, the NFL season was supposed to start that Sunday. It had to be pushed back. And then
I can tell you how that one.
November is when they wrapped it up.
Yeah, that's a big deal for September 11th. Trey Wingo, a former anchor, he has a podcast, and he had Bob Lee on. And that day, ESPN is owned by, at this point, by ABC. And they still are owned by ABC, you know, Disney, ABC, and all that.
Mm-hmm.
So it was spliced with ABC News footage, but it's Bob Lee in the anchor chair, Trey Wingo coming on too, but it's they call Bob Lee the general. So Bob Lee is there, and he's talking about what's ABC News' coverage and talking about obvious delays in the sports world, and we've never had anything like that. And this must have been in 21 or 22 when Bob Lee came on Trey Wingo's podcast. But they say every September 11th, they think about each other and they reach out to each other, because obviously we know for the country, for the world, for a lot of us, it's a day we'll never forget. But for them, you know, you're in the world of sports, you're not thinking you're going to be all day covering an attack on America like that. So just to bring that, that was also another huge moment in ESPN, but SportsCenter's history was Bob Lee anchoring that. And
And
what
it
do you
kind of
do?
fits into what we were saying before about ESPN and SportsCenter specifically had such a huge part of putting sports at the top of so many of our lists, you know, in our day-to-day lives and in what we consider in our identity, like what we, talk about as ourselves as sports fans. And of course, September 11th had everybody in the country kind of reflect and reanalyze their priorities in a way. But almost instantly, and I remember the entire entertainment world, this was the question of like, when can we go back to, if it's a comedy show, when can we go back to joking? When can we go back to, like the healing process and stuff? And I think sports, and again with the pandemic, it happened the same way. We needed to get sports first because we know what a uniting force sports can be. Even if you're not even fans of the same team, just the whole spectator aspect of sports, following sports, being interested in it is uniting. It helps us get through so many things. And so when comparing the 89 earthquake that have during right before a baseball game started, and then 9/11, which is a Tuesday morning, so it wasn't, but it was still going to impact. Sports were turned to as this is going to get us back on track. We're going to be able to push through this because we can all be distracted with sports, all focus on sports. And the reason that we're able to do that and that we want to care about them is because of SportsCenter, is because of our, almost round the clock regular updates of telling us and treating us as, an audience that they care about, that we want to know what's going on in the world of sports.
It absolutely, and you're right, Eric, where they were out before. So you look at whether it's pro sports or college sports, like USC Notre Dame rivalry, Michigan Ohio State rivalry. That was a rivalry before 79 ESPN, right? Like that's been there 100 years, that rivalry. But really, unless you were in, say for Michigan and Ohio State, unless you were in Columbus or Ann Arbor, if you're like us, you got it when ABC showed that, that Saturday right after Thanksgiving or right before Thanksgiving, well, I think it's after Thanksgiving, Michigan, Ohio State, ABC shows that game. That's your tap into that rivalry until next year. You know what I mean? Like you're not getting it. Like you get it that 1 week, unless you live in those towns. What ESPN does, you're feeling these rivalries and these fandoms 24/7 all year round. So you're getting to understand what these rivalries and fan bases mean, whether it's pro or college, you're getting to understand it more and you're feeling like, hey, you can touch it, you can see it, you can almost feel it, then besides just, hey, I'll see it next November, or if ABC has the game of the week, that's when I'll, hearing like, probably your dad, and I know hearing my dad say it, what they got was that game of the week, and that was it. Like, and then they just took that and let their imaginations flow and tried to emulate what they saw. But, and if it wasn't local, they weren't getting out there unless they got the game of the week coverage. You get what we were lucky enough, and I do really do mean lucky enough, is, hey, we're on the other side of the country, but we're getting to see Ken Griffey Jr. and see those amazing catches and home runs, or we're getting to see the Seattle Supersonics or the Lakers. We're getting to see them more up close in different places, different areas. I get to see, oh, Cameron Crazy, Duke Blue Devils, Dick Vitale. And that's, right before the game, it's a Carolina Duke game. SportsCenter kicks it to Dick Vitale and he's crowd surfing with the Cameron Crazies. And it's getting me hyped for that. Like, now I got to feel it. I got to be excited for it. I got to be like, man, I want to be there. That came from ESPN and SportsCenter.
That's a great segue to the last component of this that I want to talk to you about is I used to love when I would go to a game live, and for us it was usually because I lived at in the 90s I lived in Plattsburgh, New York, which is about an hour from Montreal. And so we'd go to Expos games. And I tell you, in the early 90s, those were the best because they were actually good then. We'd go to Expos games all the time. And we would actually, by the time we got home, it was usually around 11 o'clock, and we put on SportsCenter hoping to see the game we were just at and trying to decide, okay, what part of that game that we just watched are they going to highlight? And, mm-hmm. you know, getting kind of excited when if they showed a home run and it was a part of the bleachers we were sitting in, like, I don't think I ever got good enough to pinpoint exactly me in the, you know, in the shot, but did you have experiences like that at all where you'd go to a game and be able to watch the highlights of that same game and just see it from that different perspective?
I still have it now. I still have it now. I mean, to answer it, yes, that was definitely the case, especially if it was a big game. And, you know, I mean, all the games we felt were big, but then when you knew your team is good, and it, even if it's a regular season game, but it's a highlighted game in whatever sport, you were excited and you got to go to it. But then, yes, and especially, well, I'll take it back. If we lost, I didn't want to see the highlight. Yeah, like, yeah. I didn't want to watch it. So obviously, our team had to win. But then, yeah, you wanted to replay it. Because then you also got mad if you felt like they didn't give the game enough attention. You were like, what? Yeah, they just showed the score. They just, like, went through it real. Because, you know, there's those games where they give, like, the breakdown, and then there'd be, like, those quick ones. Like, and another NBA news, the Sixers won 94-89 over the Knicks. And the next game, and it's like, what? Yeah. That's all we get? That's like, it? So it was to see, like, because we all wanted to be, felt like our fan base, our teams were disrespected. Like, they don't like our city. They don't like our team, you know. So absolutely, always went home and wanted to. I mean, when the Eagles won the Super Bowl, I could not. Now it's crazy. It's not just ESPN. There's so many other networks.
Yeah.
And leagues have their own networks. But starting with ESPN and going to NFL Network and all the other ones, I wanted to see the highlights of, and I recorded them all. This is before I cut the cable cords.
Yeah.
So I still had DVR. I recorded all of them and kept them, Eric, for months and would rewatch not the game, but the highlights. Cause I'm like, I've never had it where the Eagles won a Super Bowl and they're doing a highlight on the Eagles winning a Super Bowl before. Yeah. And that's me. I'm a grown man and I'm feeling that.
Question that I don't always include in these breakdowns, and that is it prescriptive or descriptive? And, you know, as sports reporters, they always have to describe all the games, but when they shorten or lengthen the highlight reel or include it into the plays of the week or the top 10 of the day or whatever, that's being very prescriptive. They want the audience to feel a certain way about that game or a player or what have you. And I think that wraps things up nicely for us because it really says something about that era of SportsCenter, and that is of the 1990s, as being part of this greater mosaic of, like, every interest that you might have gets that kind of treatment. And it really demonstrates, I think, it's a great document. Maybe more people recorded things, and that would be a wonderful primary source to have on hand. And you can find them on YouTube, which is kind of funny. If you, like, type in a particular month and year and write SportsCenter, you can get old episodes. And it's like, this is a great way to do a look in at that time and place. Like, if you want to see how people dressed and talked.
Absolutely.
And what was, you know, like the references they made. Because a lot of those things that they would say in the highlights would be pop culture of the time period. know, they would reference things outside of sports. And so it makes it for a really great breakdown. And I couldn't have asked for anybody better than yourself to do this with me. Episode number one of season three and about this particular topic.
No, thank you. And I'm so glad, man. This was so much fun. And I'm so glad I did this with you. Because, you know, you're my man, and we get down, we think alike on like love and history and what connecting the past to the present and what it means and what it means for the present, but also for the future. One thing I want to say is not only am I glad to do this with you, this topic means a lot because I don't know if you're like this, Eric, but a lot of times I'll sit there and think about like what would be a good idea for a movie or a documentary. And for me, for my documentary list, this topic is near the top of it because 90s SportsCenter, we explain what it meant to the culture and what it means to a generation of people. Absolutely. But for people who don't know and listening to your show, I say Rich Eisen, Dan Patrick, who hosts huge national sports shows, crossover in the pop culture as well. I mentioned Robin Roberts, who's on Good Morning America. How many people know her? You look at Keith Olbermann, and whether you agree with his politics or not, that's your thing, but he became bigger than sports and was a big known name in cable TV for a while. It still is known. You look at from Bob Lee, you look at, like I said, Craig Kilborn, and he had his own late night show. You know, we see what Mike Tirico is doing now and Chris Fowler, and you mentioned Steve Levy and Linda Cohn, all these huge names. And in this era, the late, great Stuart Scott, in this era, they all were in Bristol at the same time working on this sports show that for us was huge, but for them, they didn't know how big it was and how many people they were reaching, mainly because, and this is what I think is really fascinating, the network wanted to stifle them. They did not want any of their anchors being bigger than the network. So they had Chris Berman as a star, and they said, and this is a direct quote, we don't want another Berman. So they purposely tried to kind of squash talent from getting too big and too big for their britches. And a lot of times their efforts to squash it bit them in the butt, and talent got creative and they got bigger.
Yeah.
But a lot of those guys did not know how big the ratings were because the network didn't want to tell them because they were afraid they'd ask for more money and all these things. And I'm very curious to see what they would think. Did that help them? I mean, no one wants to work in a not the best work environment, but did that competition, or did their bosses trying to squash their creativity, did they thrive because of it? Or if they would have had a more supportive atmosphere, it would have been better, but would they have reached their peaks as creatively if they didn't have that kind of like squashing by their executives?
Yeah.
I don't know if I'm saying it right, but I always am very curious about that.
It is. And I think it's worthy of, and if anything, that the movie Air that came out earlier this year proves that you can make a great biopic about a lot more topics than just musicians nowadays. You know, for a while, it was just, you know, like Ray Charles, Johnny Cash, and, you know,
NWA.
Right. And now it's like, well, we can even broaden it to the origins of a sneaker. You know, it's like, I think ESPN, SportsCenter, I'd watch it. I think that'd be a great movie. You know, I love behind the scenes type, you know, inside entertainment type stories. I think that'd be a fantastic biopic topic. So, absolutely, but and it's such a huge part.
And these are names now that they've all, I think, all of them now have left ESPN. And Robin Roberts is known, she's a household name from people who don't care about sports. They don't like sports. Like, and I don't know how you feel. I get a glow every time I see Robin Roberts or I see these other people.
Yeah.
And I'm like, I remember when they were on SportsCenter.
It's not quite the same as like be like, well, I knew them before they were famous. It was like, they were ours first. Like they were like,
exactly.
They spoke to us before they spoke to all of you. Like I was the one watching them at 6:30 in the morning, you know, before I got on the school bus. You weren't I know them better than I, you know, than you do, kind of thing. I know exactly what you mean. So on the horizon soon for those of you listening, Bigger Than the Game podcast, we've been working with each other for the better part of, you know, half a year now. And you and I did an episode for your show a little while ago about sports movies. Coming up soon, we're going to be doing one about sports video games.
Yes.
And actually, one of my all-time favorite games, I'll give it away now, is ESPN 2K5 Football.
Okay. I know exactly what you're talking about.
I played that game when I worked at a rec center years ago, and I was like, it was like what Madden became later on. They were already ahead of it, and it was just, I'll go on when we do that episode, but I was like, ESPN, when it entered for a very short time the sports video game world, actually did a pretty good job. I think you know, it was almost reflective of how they entered into the cable market and dominated there. So I'm looking forward to doing that with you soon. How can people
Absolutely.
Find you on social media and everywhere else?
So you can find us on social media on Instagram and Twitter at Bigger Game Pod. That's at Bigger Game Pod. You can listen to our show anywhere that you listen to podcasts, Apple, Spotify, Google Podcasts. And we also have a YouTube channel. So, and I say this, one of our most popular episodes of 2023, and I'm dead serious, is the top sports movies I did with Eric. And so if you want to listen to that episode, you can listen, like I said, Apple, Spotify, Google. If you want to watch it, we have a YouTube channel, Bigger Than the Game, with Jeremy and Jose. So you can watch it. But that is one of the most popular episodes, man,
that's very flattering.
This year. So, and I'm dead honest. So, like, and that was a fun one to do. So,
so much fun.
We can't wait to have you on again. And, you know, I'm curious because I think we're really – all three of us, you know, Jose is under the weather. He couldn't make it on here tonight. But I think we're going to have different answers. I think that's going to be fun. Like, naturally, like, I think we're going to have different answers than each other. So I'm really curious
But it's going to be a great time. And I look forward to doing that. Thank you,
Absolutely.
Everybody, for listening to the Everything is a Primary Source podcast, EPS podcast for short, where everything, including SportsCenter, is a primary source, and we'll talk to you next time. Thanks again, Jeremy.
No problem.
It's always fun talking with Jeremy, and I encourage you to check out his and his pal Jose's podcast, Bigger Than the Game, wherever you get your podcasts. Next week's episode is going to be a lot of fun. Charles in Charge is the topic, and the analysis of what it can tell us about the mid-1980s will be done with my guests Amy and Jay of the Sitcom Study podcast. Until then, don't forget to find and follow me on social media, including YouTube and especially Instagram. Subscribe to my Substack and become a patron on Patreon and to get exclusive content. You can do all of that by visiting everythinghistory.com. That's everything-history.com. I look forward to having you join us again next time for the EPS podcast, where everything is a primary source.